Wow,
you see, a violin now. But as you can see, I'm holding it in front of me rather than have it hanging across my coat.
Good afternoon, Fritz. This is December 3rd, 1975. Marion Cohn and Fay Roth with Frederick Dorion. We're glad to be here again. We have a question that goes back to Vienna, which Fay will ask now.
Can you tell us what happened to your family in Europe when you came to Carnegie Mellon in 1936?
My parents were both living when my father died during the academic year. My mother successively left her parents, where my oldest brother has been living since 1925. Brother Max, who is also a physician, is married to a French woman. He had a family of his wife. And so it was considered logical for my mother to move first to Paris, not to mention her affinity with French civilization, the fact that she spoke beautiful French and loved French art and so forth. However, my mother died in Paris, where she is buried, in 1939.
Fritz, I think this would be the point at which we could say whatever you had to say about the Nazis, your family's involvement, your involvement, anything that happened back in Vienna which touched your lives.
I experienced the Nazis on three fronts, as it were. First, when I lived in Germany, specifically when the Nazis came to power in January 1937. I lived in Berlin. And gradually saw all of that horror develop. The tempo of the development was slow because they were diplomatic and careful at the very beginning. The first anti-Semitic outburst did not happen until April 1st of the year. I left Germany in the March of 1934. Now the Austrian situation is something else, you know. Some people who experienced it told me that the Nazis were more horrible in Austria than they were in Germany, which is conceivable. It was completely unexpected because the degree of intermarriage was very high in Austria. And one thought because of that it would not happen. Anyhow, the third front is Czechoslovakia, as my father was born in a Czechoslovakian town. And my entire family in Czechoslovakia was backed up by the Nazis. There was a very large family because my father was one of 10 children. All married, all multiplied according to biblical prescriptions. And in after the Second World War, I traveled to Syria to the birthplace of my mother, hoping to be able to trace anyone of the many relatives. It was very difficult because I do not speak Czech. And I went to the mayor's office of the town. The name of the town is Ravnitz, Lubicina, near the German border. And those old Czechs who spoke German did not want to admit that they were German. So I found someone who spoke some French, and that's the way it went. I could not trace one single say out of one hundred.
Well,
then it's Czechoslovakia. in the famous ancient synagogue of Prague.
I was there.
You were there. Then you saw the list of some 70,000 murdered Jews. There you can find the names of some of the relatives. So in the meantime, it moved to Prague. Forgive me, Mario, I don't know that you were about to ask me a question.
I was going to say was that your father had passed away, your mother had moved to France. Both of your brothers were in France, or just one?
No, I brought my brother Paul, my second brother, I brought him over in time, in 1938. There was no problem with Max, because he's a Frenchman, and
And your brother Paul came to this country?
I brought him to this country.
He's the one that's in California
he's
now.
In California.
I see. Well, I think that, Faye, if you agree, that we could go on to life in America.
One other question. Are there any old friends that you keep in touch with today? Is that from Vienna or from Germany?
Both. You see, Faye, I may say, without any exaggeration, that I try to keep in touch with old friends. Care to keep in touch with me, it's not always good children, you know, and carry on to this day an enormous correspondence that takes a great deal of time, but ends up to no end. At any time, say the letter from the Maples, a letter from Australia, New Zealand, you mentioned there was a time when they were in China and Shanghai. The diaspora had driven all over Europe. Not to mention friends who are here, but there are very few left outside, so, because some of my closest friends were killed by the Nazis.
You anticipated my next question. I was going to ask.
You have to move closer.
It's kind of a story connected with Pittsburgh. Early after my arrival here, I met a number of Jewish doctors among them, Dr. David Kastos, a new surgeon, was a very enormously helpful and trying to help me to bring people out of Austria. I succeeded in bringing 11 people to Austria, which is a small number. But you must consider that I arrived with no money and no connections and no relatives here, and that legally what you needed were affidavits of support, in which the person who sends the affidavit had to assume full responsibility financially for the person. It wasn't too easy, but there was a doctor's committee here. And one case was extremely tragic. My closest friend was a physician by the name of Dr. Theodore B.A.U.R. And Dr. Kaskov sent the affidavit for him and went so far, David Kaskov,
Dr. Yale
Cosmos? Dr. Yale,
the neurosurgeon.
Oh, it's Dr. Yale.
Yale
David. Yeah. Still mm-hmm. He was very involved in that role. We became very close friends.
Well, how did you get connected with Dr. Cosmos?
Well, I just met him socially,
I see.
I mean, I met quite a number of doctors socially.
I think that the part about a doctor's committee having been formed to bring German Jews over who were in trouble is very interesting, and I think we ought to talk about that a lot.
With great pleasure. Because, you see, it interested me particularly because there were two. I had the material motive to bring two of my close doctors over in the meantime, or rather three. One had succeeded in the war. He came to Pittsburgh, actually. Mm-hmm. And then went on to New York.
Fritz, can you tell us, if you can remember, who were the men on that committee?
Yes, I remember some, because, you see, I was so involved in it. I think the head was Dr. Bachrach. Yes. Another man active on the committee was the ophthalmologist Dr. Isaac Davis, father of Lang, friend, there was laryngologist, Dr. Siegel, Dr. Simon Siegel. You are lucky, you have two of those people. They are gone. This exception of David Casper. Dr. Siegel, who had also something to do with it, academic, here comes the tragedy. They were both slaughtered in Theresienstadt. I have some picture here in the concentration camp. We went to Prague, I met his widow. This was my closest friend. You know, I went with him to kindergarten, to grade school, to high school, and even when he went into medicine, I attended many medical lectures. So he attended many lectures. He was in my body. And I was very close to his wife. And the affidavit did arrive. But as his wife told me in Prague, the American vice counsel sold the affidavit to another Jew who drank. It was one of the most terrible stories. She knew all the answers. Because I couldn't understand, as we had sent all of them. And as I was not without connections to the American embassy, I cannot tell you how tragic. I went to Washington, D.C. Actually, it is inconceivable. When I left Vienna, the American ambassador, was a man who later became Assistant Secretary of State, Eleanor Roosevelt. He had a German accounting secretary, be contaminated. He was very kind to me because I was invited to a party to the American Embassy through Eugene Ormandy, to Philadelphia, conducting Broadway. And he told me that if I ever came to the country, I should not hesitate to call him. I did go to Washington, I did call on him, and he met me, you can happen only in America.
Excuse me, what did you
say? Can happen only in America.
Yes.
Before you leave to me, I believe so dear. Yeah. See, something thrilling happens to me right now, because see, I couldn't remember the name of the person on the telephone, I cannot remember.
Freudian.
And in spite of the fact that I had relatively strong connections, reaching even into the State Department. I couldn't save the life of those two doctors. The other doctor was Dr. Kurt Deutsch, my lifelong friend.
But Fritz, isn't it amazing? After all, you didn't get here till 1936, is that correct?
Yeah.
The thing that I think is so remarkable is how you didn't speak English when you arrived, scarcely, a little bit. That what you accomplished in only 3 years' time.
Because, you see, I had friends. See, you come in, this is an extremely hospitable part of the United States. We already done with in the middle of it. We know where it's open. And then, of course, the Jewish community was very cordial, but I must say the Gentiles were no less cordial, and they still make us feel cordial.
I wanted to ask you also, were there any Gentile doctors on the committee?
No, not on the committee, as far as I know. It was a Jewish issue. But I had managed to come. For example, I met Rolfes, and I met Anna Drew. But she wasn't yet in the medical field. She was engaged to a very famous doctor, Dr. Selman, who went to Montreal. But it has nothing to do with the issue. But I met quite a number of influential and wealthy Gentiles who were willing to help her and they asked me whether they could do something. So those two friends of mine perished. The little brothers were more fortunate who came over. The doctor who came over here was Dr. Hans Schlein. And he went to school, he went to school, he went to school, and went on to me.
Fritz, you didn't serve as an American soldier in World War II,
well,
or did you?
I came very close to it. You see, actually, my ear was caught very late. And I was already married, because he didn't divorce at 21, but he had no children. And I was very anxious to serve, for reasons which I have to explain. After all, the war against Hitler could be organized. In addition, I had other reasons to make me very anxious. It was actually embarrassing at university to be at the Lutz faculty room with the colleagues, one after another, going into the war. You remember, I was still in my still in my theater.
You're talking about Carnegie Mellon.
Carnegie Mellon. You see, I remember one of my colleagues, the psychologist Gilmore, who is still around, he says, you know, I'm going to go, you know.
Well, when did you become a citizen?
A citizen in 1941, the United States entered the war. All right. I had become a citizen.
So he said, Fritz, when are you going to war?
I was already a citizen. But now here's what happened. I went with my brother-in-law, Harold Neagle, husband of Sid's sister.
Excuse me, can we stop? I don't think we have covered.
All right. So there existed in Pittsburgh, downtown, a procurement office for commissions. Now, you see, university teachers, according to their rank, they are given commissions. Say, an assistant professor might get might be commissioned, first lieutenant, and an associate professor might be captain, mayor, and so on. I thought that it would be cute to be a captain of the American Army. I also thought, to be more serious about such a serious matter, that with my languages and my geographical knowledge of Europe, which I really saw, you know, there's hardly one European country where I wouldn't have been. And I have an interest in geography, know something about that. I thought I could serve in the intelligence and applied for a commission. It never went beyond the receiving secretary of the procurement office. I was never even received by the colonel sitting there. The reason for that, because I inquired. I inquired because my American colleagues all received commissions. By the way, did you remember Nazi Gardner?
No.
Lillian Kaufman, that was known.
Oh, Lillian Kaufman.
Well, Nazi. None of us foreign-born, if we are born in a country against which the war was taking place, namely Germany and Austria, received the commission because we were not trusted. And that, of course, made sense, considering the degree of spying and so on. It did not make sense to mistrust an Austrian Jew trying to reach the world from Hitler. But they didn't take the chance for that reason. I could not get into the life. I was still in good health. But you didn't know me then.
No. I didn't really know you, I don't think, until 1949.
That's right. Yeah. In 49 I could speak that.
Yeah.
49, 50. Yeah. So this answers war service, right?
Yes.
This answers that. You were not in this country during the Depression, really.
No.
No.
And even the late, I mean, it's not the 60s, but still after the effects of the Depression.
Right.
Yes.
And I think now that we ought to go to the thing that will give you the most pleasure, which is how you, when you met Sadie, how you met her. And we'll talk about your courtship and your marriage.
I met Sadie at a meeting to organize a chamber music society in Pittsburgh that did not exist.
How long, when was that, Fritz?
That was in 1938.
38. You'd been here just 2 years and you met
Sadie.
Less
than 2 years.
Less than 2 years.
Yes. Yeah. And that meeting took place in the house of the pianist Earl White, Pittsburgh pianist, who was well known
by Earl Wilde.
W-I-L-D.
What was Sadie's maiden name?
Sadie Kerner. She's a girl.
And she came from a rather large family, did she not?
Seven brothers and sisters. Two brothers, five sisters.
Five sisters. Well, you were...
I was supposed to be a founder of the society. You see, Earl Wilde, at that time, was a graduate student in our music department. But he had not any graduate, but at any rate, the meeting was really one of young people who loved music. And they were supposed to be called the Brahms Society.
The Brahms Society.
Brahms Society.
And tell me, why was Sadie there?
Because, you see, young people is identical interests who would be willing to work for such a society. So when you are working, you see, you give up your time and energy out of love, involvement into this cause. It's a pleasure to be sitting here with you, so for a lot of societies, a certain number of people were willing to make errands or to pay some money. And her sister-in-law also came, Hannah Redfield, do you know
her? Yes, Hannah? I do.
Hannah came. Hannah and Sadie came.
And did you begin immediately to court Sadie?
Yes. You see, I was very strict with her, let's say. And speaking about Brahms, you see, the society was called Brahms Society. Klemperer was in town, the great conductor of the Klemperer, whom I had known very well before. And in the next week, he conducted a concert with the Brahms Symphony, the Third Symphony of Paris. So I asked Sadie whether she would care to come with me to the concert. And it was about this. We married in 1940.
Fritz, where did you and Sadie live when you were first married?
In a small house, a small house that still exists. On the first floor is Frances Bloom. Did you know her?
Oh, of course. I did know her.
Her brother was president of Guinness.
It was Jack Bloom, right,
Jack
of course.
Bloom.
Yes.
But she married. I don't know where she is. I haven't seen her.
Right.
She lives on the first floor. She lived in the morning and went to Guinness and left her dog, a cocker spaniel, screaming and yelling and harping and barking the whole day. And I wrote her a letter, in this poem, I'm in possession. The dog has no mercy upon me, you know? But it was schoolhouse, it was quite charming at that time.
Oh, it's still a charming street.
Tiny house.
Yeah. And did you move from Schoolhouse Lane to this apartment here?
Not directly, you see, we moved into a house owned by the university that no longer exists. There were a few old houses there on that ground prior to this dormitory. And that's where we left. They were all university owned, the money faculty left to this house.
I remember them.
Small,
they were on Forbes Street.
Of course, the one, the head of the English department was the one I do not know, was the head of Paris. And the architect Pedro, and the head of the psychology department. So, it was a little family group, it was very charming, very friendly, very American, the best of the world.
Fritz, was a lot of your social life, I know, would like to talk about it now because it would be wonderful for our children to know about Gladys Schmidt and so on, and the people with whom you and Sadie communicated socially.
Well, you see, to a great extent, intermurally, it's in a way. It doesn't mean that the university doesn't assess yourself too much with the colleagues. But Carnegie Mellon Peak, having one of the same roof, many other partners, architects of painting, and have a structure of closing down. So naturally it fell into pattern. But as a week is only 7 days. To spend the greater of time, which I think is often the best, is your college. I learned the great from my college, I'm deeply grateful, because if I hadn't learned anything else except the language, the idiom, say, in drama, which I knew in German, see. And Gladys, as you say, was one of my, I came out of my ears, but there's half a day in my life that I don't still think about.
Fritz, did you and Sadie take vacations? I know you have taken many.
Yes, we agreed that for vacations. Thank all of us.
And you went?
7 times back and forth to California. Because I don't have to tell you that, but it means for Europeans to discover the comparable beauty of the United States. Moving on to the world, the Grand Canyon, Utah. The Grand Stevens.
They're wonderful.
And we always took the car. See, that's one of the advantages of the college scholarship. We don't teach some students. If you're in education.
Was there any other particular thing that either one of you did in your leisure time? We call them hobbies.
Sadie had a profession. She was a social worker for many years. Also after all. For years.
Oh, I never knew that.
She worked in the Department of Public Assistance. That was one of the highest things I knew before my father was extremely attractive girl for helping my colleague. Went to my family, and she gives all of her time. You see, I accompanied her, something I wasn't supposed to do. When I met her, I was very interested in her work. And she took me to the ghettos, which really actually existed. Her clients were miserable. And her difficulty was that when the check didn't come through for her clients, which often happened, bureaucracy or something, people didn't have anything to eat. This is how she spent her salary, giving secret money to the clients.
Giving what kind of money?
No, the kind of money she earned. She has a good now, there's no question about that. Because we are in this illusion, this excessive problem. This is what she did until lately when she decided that I needed more help in my profession, not to mention my illness, but she gave the position up way before my illness. Can I help me with my books, you see?
And I think that, I think it would be very interesting to know about her contribution to the books and just exactly how she has fit into your profession.
Well, you can see that in her afternoon of belonging, I had to promise her before you came not to say too much about her, but to ask her this question after her conference. Her contribution is immense. If we are on a psychological sustain you know, in university life, you're very, let me first tell you what I had to do at the university so that you see how little time I had for my research. For 18 years I was conductor of the school orchestra, and of the chorus, you know. I founded the opera department, which is my profession. Gave recitals. To be a little girl that introduced Marlon and Brooklyn, as well as Michael Baker, to Pittsburgh, where we said, when I gave the first performances.
That's remarkable!
In these days, these performances were still critically written up in the newspapers.
And where did you give these?
In Carnegie Hall. All in Carnegie Hall. First performance of Marlon's second symphony, Brooklyn's romantic symphony, of Schoenberg's. Peace on earth of the aina kiinnostunut siitä, että maailmassa se on tuossa viikkoa ja kiinnostunut koska tietää.
Who financed the concerts?
Of these concerts were school concerts, you know, but it's not quite a Carnegie Mellon community orchestra. They had a less fancy name. But another organization which I found in Pittsburgh,